Welcome to Bodcast, the Business of Dentistry podcast, brought to you by Practice Plan. Bodcast delivers the best business advice, real-life stories, and practical hints and tips to make your practice a more profitable and sustainable business. And now, here's your host.
Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Nigel Jones, Sales and Marketing Director at Practice Plan, and today I'm joined by Richard Collard, who spent 35 years working with the dental profession and the dental industry, the last decade of which has been spent specifically helping practices look at ways of increasing their treatment plan uptake. So what we want to do today is just explore some of the things that he's learned, some of the advice and some of the guidance that he's been giving to practices over those last 10 years or so. And one of the reasons why I think that's particularly interesting is when you look at how the market is likely to develop over the next few years, it's clear from the various market reports like Lang & Buisson that although there will be growth in the value of the overall dental market in the UK, there won't be growth in the NHS part of that. That looks set to either be very steady or potentially to even decrease, according to some commentators. The growth will all be in the private side of dentistry. And when you break that down, the lion's share of that will be in the cosmetic dentistry side of the market. And that's, I think, an area of particular interest to an enormous number of practices. And what I'd really like to do, Richard, if it's okay, is just to understand a little bit about what you think practices can do to make sure they maximise their share of that increasing market. And actually, to make sure that they maximise the chance of being as beneficial as possible to their patients, because fundamentally that's what it should all be about. So what sort of advice and guidance would you give to people?
Well, this is a huge area. I think there's lots of things that we can probably explore in this little session that we're going to have. I think one of the most important things that I've found is that there's a lot of business walks out of dental practices every day of the week for the sake of a good conversation. It's having the right amount of time to be able to sit down with a patient, understand things from their perspective. So that would be the first place I would start. I would be looking at spending a little bit more time with patients. What about you? What have you picked up in terms of your conversations with practices that you've been to?
Well, I think the point that you've just made is very valid. There have been numerous anecdotes and stories that I've heard along the years about patients that have been regular attenders at a particular practice reappearing, having gone and had some form of cosmetic dentistry at another practice, where their argument is they just didn't realise that the practice that they've been going to for years and years actually provided that care themselves.
That was a classic case with a friend of mine who was telling me the story. This was a couple of years ago, about a guy who came in to see him for a six-month review, and my friend took one look at him and went, "Where did you get those done?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, those veneers." So I had them done. I had them done about 3 months ago. Well, why do you have them done here? I didn't know you did them. So a classic marketing impasse, if you like, has taken place because a good conversation hasn't taken place, because there's nothing in the practice as well saying we do these kinds of treatment.
Yeah.
The patient has automatically assumed that, well, they don't do them here, but there's a great cosmetic practice down the road, so they went and had them done there. And so he waved goodbye to several thousand pounds worth of business for the sake of, one, a good conversation, and two, making sure that what he did was patently obvious to his patient base. Yeah.
I think that's really interesting, because one of the things that's become a bit of a hobby horse of mine is when people talk about patients these days becoming more consumerist in their behaviour. And that we should think of them as consumers. Now, I agree to that, but only to a certain extent, because I still believe that when a patient is looking for a dentist that they are going to visit on a routine basis for their six-monthly examinations, they're generally arriving at that appointment not necessarily knowing whether or not they've got a problem. So they have to completely trust the person that's telling them that they've got a problem that they didn't know about.
Sure.
For me, that involves a very different mentality, and the way they choose those dentists is based an awful lot on referrals, it's based on recommendation, friends, family, that kind of thing. Whereas, if they can self-diagnose, if they know they need straighter, whiter teeth, if they know they've got a gap they want filled, if they know that they've got unsightly teeth that they would like to potentially mask through veneers,
sure.
I think they feel empowered to behave like consumers. So in that sense, then they start shopping around and start going on the website and start looking for different places that they could potentially receive those solutions. And that means that if you're looking for that kind of a patient, you have to behave differently with your patients because you don't know if they're behaving in a consumer-like way for those sorts of solutions. Does that sort of thing make sense?
Totally makes sense. And you mentioned that bit about straighter, whiter teeth as well. If we accept, I do a lot of work with practices, running workshops and doing in-practice bespoke sessions. One of the things that everyone seems to agree with is that what most people aspire to these days is straighter, whiter teeth. There are things that get in the way of them having that. There are things that stop that being a priority, not least of which could be fear. Another one could be cost, all of those kinds of things. But if we accept that people want straighter, whiter teeth, how can they get that on the health service as an adult, other than a denture? So a lot of the time, practices are talking to patients about stuff that the patient doesn't really want because they're focusing on NHS-type treatments. And this isn't meant to knock the NHS at all. But if we don't understand what it is that our patients want and then tell them that what they want, they can get it here, they are going to go somewhere else. If we understand that marketing really, this is my definition of marketing, it's understanding what people want and ensuring that they know they can get it from you. That's that sort of little encapsulation of that. Now, sometimes we can understand what people want, but we don't make a good job of them of ensuring that they know that they can get it from us, which was the classic story behind that dentist I was telling you about, who's a good friend of mine. Exactly. He could perfectly well do the job, but didn't ensure that what the person wanted, that they knew it was available from him. So there's a marketing slant to this as well.
Absolutely, and I think those two components that you've just spoken about are really important. The bit about presenting the solutions, as your anecdote illustrated so well, there's stuff that can be done about that. The bit before about understanding what people want and they need, that's one of the areas where I feel practices could make some significant progress. Mm. Creating the right environment for a patient from the very first contact they have with the practice that allows them to feel sufficiently calm and relaxed and free to open up about what their concerns are, I think is so important. And I think part of the reason why a patient like the one that you were describing before might end up at a different practice is because they don't realise something's available there, but is also because they didn't necessarily feel comfortable enough having the kind of conversation that allowed the need to be identified by the practice. And for me, that whole kind of patient journey, taking someone through to the point at which they're making a decision about potentially how to finance an expensive course of treatment, is something that a lot of practices understand conceptually, but you don't necessarily see being put into practice, even down to things like the way that the telephone inquiries are handled. And I know you've done an awful lot of work with practices on how to approach that very, very start point of the patient journey.
Well, you've mentioned a number of things, sort of taking a patient through something. You've got the start point, patient journey you've mentioned. What you're pointing to is really what I would call sales process. It's about understanding that process, making it as easy to manage as possible, making it as comfortable for the patient as possible. And then when you determine what your process is, determining what are the skill sets required at particular points. You'll need different people with different skills. You've mentioned the telephone. A lot of people that operate on the telephone that frankly don't have the skills to be on the telephone. They end up inadvertently becoming sales prevention officers, if I can refer to them as that. It's maybe a bit unkind, but you know what I mean. So it's getting the process right, and then it's getting the right people in place with the right skills. And really what it comes down to is being able to focus in on these key communication skills, which are merely orientated around how to have a good conversation. And a good conversation between people that know each other well, a little bit like, you know, we're doing now, is a bit of a sort of a trading of opinion and ideas. But when you don't know someone too well and you're wanting to get to know them and wanting to understand what's important to them, then it's having the ability to ask the right kinds of questions and the ability to listen, hear what's coming back, and then show that you've listened by then asking an appropriate question on into the next phase of the conversation. But someone who's being asked about what's important to them and how they would rate their own dental health, for example, on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being rubbish and 10 being great, how they would rate their dental aesthetics, how your teeth look, Mrs. Smith, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being terrible, 10 being fantastic. Where would you put yourself there? And then listening to the answers that come back and getting them to self-assess themselves, because you're only going to be able to present a solution to somebody if there is a dissatisfaction or a problem. And the trouble that a lot of practices fall into, a lot of traps they fall into, is trying to present solutions too quickly to a need that has not been articulated by the patient and only been identified by the clinician.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think the danger with that is that you can end up with a no as the response to it.
Yeah.
And that then reinforces the perception that so many within the profession have, which is that they shouldn't be selling in the first place. Mm. Whereas one of the things that I think is so important is I despair almost of just how many patients are out there who are inadvertently being denied solutions to
Absolutely.
Issues that they've got.
Yeah.
Because of this inconsistent communication within the practices. Mm. I think when you look at the thank you letters that some practices get, mm-hmm. the way that some people's lives have been transformed, whether it's to do with job interviews or confidence at weddings in being photographed or social life or even getting to the point of getting married, all these sorts of things. The ability of a dental practice to transform lives is got to be one of the most motivating, rewarding aspects of dental practice.
Totally.
So
totally.
For me, it's far less to do with selling in the context of selling people something they don't really need. It's a more mature definition of selling, which is understanding what they need, helping them feel comfortable articulating that, and then matching that need to the kind of solutions that they as clinicians have the knowledge about and the patient does have.
Well, that's really good, and you mentioned this sort of definition of selling. My definition, which I think really fits with what you're saying, is this. Selling is not about trying to get people to part with money for something that you've got or that you do that they don't want. That's market traders. Selling in a professional environment is about building relationships with the right kinds of patients, right kinds of people, to be able to then understand their problems and to then present them with some solutions, even if they end up saying no at the end. But it's understanding that selling is not a dirty word. It's about relationship building, understanding what people want, telling them therefore what you can do, and then leaving the decision to them. It's enabling them to have that truly informed choice. Now, there's a lot of patients leave practices, as I said before, up and down the country every day of the week who have consented to treatment, but I wonder how many of them have actually been able to give truly informed consent.
Yeah.
They've said yes, but have they really understood? And so I come back down to giving more time to help patients understand the treatment options and to be able to understand the different ways of paying for treatment is so key. And it's of no surprise to me that over the years, those practices that have developed that aspect of their process, particularly those with treatment coordinators or somebody who takes on that role at a particular point in time. Some practices have got treatment coordinators full-time. Others, it's a more part-time role. It might be the practice manager that does it. But having that function within the practice to be able to take the patient from the clinician and frankly, often put the treatment into more layman terms, help the patient understand them, talk them through the payment options. No wonder they get more yeses to treatment.
Yeah, and I completely agree with that. The priority that's attached to making sure that the patient does have sufficient airtime, because it's not just about helping them understand, it's about having the time to listen to them, properly understand them. I think those practices that have invested in someone with treatment coordinator responsibilities, whether it's part-time or full-time, tend to find that lends itself to the kind of relationship building and rapport building that allows patients to explain what they want more. And I Going back to an earlier thing that we were exploring, I was in one of our practices where they just received a thank you letter from the patient. And the patient was saying, it's been absolutely fantastic what you've done for me. This course of treatment, which cost £7,000, course of treatment has been miraculous for me. It's changed my life. I'm so, so grateful to you. The only thing that I would change is I wish you'd listened to me properly 3 years earlier when I first mentioned it.
Yeah.
So it wasn't going to change the cost. Yeah. She wasn't going to change the clinical aspects of it. Just actually, she'd kind of given a clue that she needed it earlier. Mm. And I think that the reason why that hadn't been picked up on was the practice was too busy, too focused on moving on to the next patient and being run efficiently as opposed to effectively from a patient experience point of view. But I also think that the point about treatment coordinators is it's great to have someone that has that focus. What you can't do is abdicate responsibility for the rest of the practice team to that individual.
True.
The whole practice team have to be involved. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important point for the people that are answering the phone, because they quite often will believe their role is effective management of the appointment book. Whereas in actual fact, they're the very first point of contact for a patient that may part with £5,000, £10,000, X number of weeks down the line. So with that in mind, you would approach that call differently to if actually, I just need to run the book efficiently.
Absolutely. And it's getting people to understand that every time the phone rings, it could be another potential piece of treatment that could be several thousands of pounds. When I used to work in a company years back, Kevo Dental, there'll be some people listening who will know the name Kevo. We used to have a customer service manager at the time who every time the phone rang, sat in his department. I got a problem actually with it being called a customer service department, because that tends to suggest that the other departments had nothing to do with customer service. That customer service is a mentality, but anyway, customer service department, there he was, the customer service manager, the phone rang, and he would sit back in his chair and announce very loudly, another golden sales opportunity, which put you in the right mentality for when you picked up the phone, because you thought this is a phone call with great potential, probably. How I answer that, how I get my first sentence out is so important in terms of the impression that I make. And of course, when you are on the end of a telephone and you're not seeing somebody, you're listening to what they say, you're hearing how they say it, and within seconds you've created a visual of that individual. Do you want to meet them? Don't you want to meet them? And that's the challenge for so many people on reception desks up and down the country, is what image are they putting in a potential patient's mind? Does that patient really want to come and see what they've been listening to?
And I think it gets particularly difficult for a number of the front desk team that I've interacted with over the years, because so much is asked of them.
Mm.
They are so busy. They are busy trying to answer a phone and create the right impression through the phone.
Yep.
At the same time as create the right impression for the person that's standing right in front of them at the desk potentially, whilst at the same time trying to avoid being distracted by the dentist that's wanting to have a quick word before they see the next patient.
Sure, sure.
So I think there's a big responsibility on the practice owner and the practice manager to create the right environment that allows someone on the front desk to flourish in that bigger role than just managing the appointment book.
Mm-hmm.
And that does mean potentially ensuring they're adequately resourced at the front desk.
Totally
it does mean
right.
that they've got the right knowledge, and if they need it, have been given some help on the skills side of things. Because you mentioned a few times, actually, that this art of a good conversation, which everyone would think they've got, but actually structuring it and thinking about it, there's a bit more to it than just chatting.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No, it's really interesting, this whole business of the telephone, and so many practices that I meet with, their solution to the problem that they have perceived or self-diagnosed is, we need to train the front desk team to do better, because they perceive that they're not seeing not necessarily the same number of patients, or they're not doing the same amount of business that they were 6 months ago. But actually, and I know you're very hot on this whole business about measurement, you know, measuring your key performance indicators within a practice. And one of the things we try and get people to look at is, how many inquiries do you get? Where do they come from? And how many of those inquiries then turn into consultations? Because actually what you are then doing is measuring how good the front desk is at that first part. But then once it comes in for consultation, how many of those consultations turn into treatment? Because then you're measuring how good your process is beyond the reception desk. And it's fascinating how many times when you actually go in and do this exercise, you find actually the front desk team is pretty good, but your problem lies further downstream with the way that treatments are being articulated, with the way that patients' wants and needs are stroke are not being discussed, the way that money is being talked about. So you get people trying to sort out a solution in their practice, but they're diagnosing the problem incorrectly.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and you're absolutely right. It's another one of my hobby horses to talk about measurement and conversion rates. So a lot of the time the answer is more marketing, more adverts, yeah, more leaflet drops.
Absolutely.
And in some cases that might be absolutely appropriate, but in many, many cases it's actually to do with maybe the way that the front desk are able to handle the calls, or to do with, as you quite rightly say, the way that the discussions are held within the surgeries, or potentially the way the discussions are followed up further on down the line. A simple call that happens a week, 2 weeks after someone's had a discussion around treatment plan options but not made a decision can work wonders. And following up on that, where people get distracted by day-to-day life and forget to focus on it, a simple thing like that can make a difference.
Well, that's
and
process, you see. We come back to what you're talking about. It's having that set process. So what is our follow-up process?
Yeah.
You know, and do we do that every time?
Well, I for me, when we're approaching this whole subject, I think that's one of the most important things, which is, yes, to borrow from industry and look at process and think about process management and process design, which for me is around looking at the different steps that a patient would go through on their way to making a decision about a treatment plan. And to be very clear about who is responsible for each of those steps, so that people very clearly understand their roles, but then also can pass the baton effectively to the next person. So quite often, the clinician, the dentist, is the worst person to talk about the money side of things. They have to have a nod towards it.
Yeah.
But being clear about who is the person that's going to talk about it. I have met practitioners that are very able, very adept when it comes to talking the money side of it. I've met significantly more that are uncomfortable with it. So being able to allocate that specific responsibility to a member of the team that is comfortable with it just makes loads of sense. So if you can map all of that out and make sure that the different people at the different stages are armed with the right level of skills and the right level of knowledge, so it becomes a very smooth, seamless journey for the patient through to making that decision, I think that's so important. And that's what you generally see is lacking in a lot of practices.
It is. And the thing, of course, is that in a single-handed practice, one dentist, you can devise a process which you can replicate the whole time. You get it right every time. You've got one dentist. You work in a practice where you've got a number of dentists. You've got one dentist who likes to work this way. You've got another dentist who likes to work that way, and another dentist who works this way. So you've got three processes, and the support team having to adapt the processes depending on who they deal with. And so you end up with inconsistencies. You end up with a massive training problem because you've got three different ways essentially of doing the same thing. So the practices that do well accept that there are differences, but actually say what we want to do is to come down to a common process that we all adhere to, so that we make it easier for our support staff, for our front desk team, for our treatment coordinators, so on and so forth. And that actually is a wonderful thing to get involved with, that you see so much change in practices when you do something like that with them. And you see such a massive impact on treatment uptake and obviously an increase in business.
Well, I've seen you carry out that sort of exercise with people. I think you call it swim lane.
That's right, yes.
You're process mapping, and you've got like a sheet of, well, roll of brown paper, and there's different post-it notes representing the different stages of the journey.
Very low tech.
Very, very low tech. But very, very effective in two ways, from what I've seen, is it is quite a good team building exercise. I think because you're involving everyone and acknowledging the importance of each role in this whole patient journey, and allowing people the airtime to talk about, you know, what works well, what works less well, and what sort of barriers they come up against. It's quite motivating for people to be involved in that. But the output from it, which is so important, is, as you say, that kind of consistent, uniform understanding of the process that you're going to get the patient to follow to maximise the chance of treatment plan uptake. There's no guarantees in any of this.
No.
But what you're wanting to make sure is that a patient, if they decide against treatment, is deciding against it for sound reasons, not reasons because they didn't quite understand
exactly
what was involved. One of the things I've heard you talk about with that particular point in mind, which I think is so interesting, is looking for the question behind the question, where you got to be careful that you don't just answer some questions from patients at face value. Would you mind elaborating a bit on that?
Do you mean something, for example, like where a patient could ask an orthodontist, for example, or ask one of the reception team, how long does orthodontic treatment take? Is that the kind
That's
of thing?
That's the kind of thing, yeah.
Right, okay. We do this as an exercise, and often you'll say to a group of people, well, just answer this question then. The patient is saying to you, how long does orthodontic treatment take? And most of them go, well, it depends on the situation, but anything from sort of 18 months to 2 years. Okay. Now, that's fine. That is factually correct. And the patient is interested in time. But if you're saying it's 18 to 24 months and the wedding that they're going to, what they want straighter teeth for, is in 12 months' time, they're on the end of the phone, they're probably going to go, okay, thanks, and put the phone down. Whereas if one is able to answer that question to some extent non-specifically, not dodge it, but non-specifically, and try and just dig a little bit behind, it's what I call the wing mirror technique. It's looking behind what's going on. And so to answer it in a little bit like this, so how long does orthodontic treatment take? Well, that will depend a little bit on the patient themselves and the treatment that would be appropriate in this particular situation. What is it specifically about time that's of concern to you, or what time frames are you working to? Would start to get you a little bit more information and start to help build a conversation. Well, actually, my daughter's getting married in 12 months' time, and you know, I really don't. And so the conversation starts to roll a little bit. So it's not answering factually right at the beginning. It's trying to answer in a way that is going to get a conversation going and build some rapport and get people opening up to you a little bit more, to the point that actually the price doesn't really matter, because what they're buying is the outcome.
Yeah. Well, since you've mentioned price, I think one of the objections that you can come up against is cost. And I think that you don't necessarily uncover that unless you're having a proper conversation with someone. There's a difference, and again, this is something I've heard you talk about, the difference between cost and affordability. And again, would you like to elaborate a little bit about that?
I mean, well, obviously cost is what the cost is now. So if the treatment is £2,000, it's £2,000. But there's the cost over time one has to consider as well. So you'll hear people like Ashley Latter talking about it's an investment. And he's absolutely right. This is an investment in your dental health going forward. So you're looking at, well, here I am at 58. I know I don't look it, but here I am at 58. And so spending £2,000 now, and if I get another 20 years of this life, I would consider that to be a very good investment over a period of time. But then it's addressing it from the point of view of affordability. So yes, it's £2,000, but if I could break that down, it's like anything, if I could break that down over 10 months to £200 a month, that's going to make it a lot more achievable for me. And I don't have to part with £2,000 now. And that, of course, has been really the whole reason that patient finance has taken off so dramatically within the last 10 years, I would think. We've seen practices understanding that the cost is one thing, but if you focus on the affordability, the cost just diminishes into the background.
Yeah. No, that's been really interesting talking to you today, Richard. I mean, if I have an attempt at a summary of our discussion, that it feels very much to me as if there's a lot of potential going to be available for practices when it comes to the field of cosmetic dentistry in particular over the next few years. And it's really a question of examining themselves to see how they can best tap into that potential for the benefit of their patients and the benefit of the business of running their dental practice. And it sounds as if what we've been saying is that at the heart of this is having a sales process tailored to suit that particular practice, because a single-handed practice has maybe different set of circumstances to a multi-handed practice. But having a sales process where the different people involved have a very clear understanding of their role in helping the patient reach a decision about their treatment plan uptake. They have the right skills, they have the right knowledge, they have the right environment in which to maximise the chance of the patient making an informed decision. And that the process of developing the process allows you to be clear about where the baton is passed on, so there's no dropping of it, no issues with the patient being left in the dark about something. That you play to people's strengths along that whole patient journey. That you find ways of uncovering their objections by developing the kind of communication skills and the conversation type skills that will allow people to properly open up and properly explain what challenges they've got.
That's right.
And then you can match the solutions to that. It might be a solution to do with the timing of treatment. It might be a solution to do with the immediate aftermath of treatments. You know, how long will they be out of action for might be a big consideration. It might be to do with the cost, and you can talk about finance as a way of helping them make it more affordable. But if you can map that whole process out and have everyone well informed, then it feels to me as if you're giving the patient the best possible chance of reaching a decision which, as I said fairly early on, could be transformational for them. And I
totally,
think that is
totally right.
So motivating for practice. The more people that they have going out of their practice feeling indebted to them for having helped change their lives immeasurably, that can only be a huge motivation factor.
They will just go and tell other people, won't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, thank you very much for your time today, Richard. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Pleasure. Good to be with you too.
Speak to you soon. Cheers.
Cheers. Bye-bye.